Well, friends, we are joined today as we continue on in the Divine Conspiracy Project. We're joined today with my friend Steve Carter, who is coming to us from the Residence Inn right now, the lovely, or maybe not, some sort of Marriott hotel is my assumption is where I'm seeing you.
Yeah, I'm getting, you got to get those Bonvoy points, man. You know, just it's nothing says you're a three when you are just acclimating American Airlines miles and Bonvoy points. So, but Mike, man, I love this conversation that you're having around Divine Conspiracy. And, you know, I love you and thanks for having me on.
Dude, just a gift to get to have you here. And Steve, for those of you who don't know, he is the best-selling author of the book, The Thing Beneath the Thing. He hosts a podcast called Craft and Character, talks about preaching and about the intersection of the craft of preaching and who we are becoming as people. He's a coach to communicators, and he serves as a teaching pastor at a church called Forest City Church in the Chicagoland area, and is like all over the place, like preaching, teaching, and genuinely like one of the best human beings alive. And one of the fun things about this conversation, I think when we post this, your newest book will have just released like a day or two before. That's called Grieve, Breathe, Receive. And I've gotten a chance to get to read an early copy of it. And I told you when I was reading it that it was like genuinely so good. And it's not just because you're my friend. Like it was so good, I didn't want to put it down. And I was telling Allison a bit about it after I'd finished it and about how you in this book, like unpack this rhythm of grieve, breathe, and receive. And you tell your own story with like your bio dad and your stepdad who you called dad, which had loss and grief attached to it. Your story of Willow Creek in the last several years that had loss and grief attached to it. And she asked me, she goes, would anyone who's not in church leadership and doesn't care about the story of Willow Creek, like care about it? Cause like, that's not her world. And she's, and I told her, I was like, I feel like anyone who has lost something or had something taken away unexpectedly, like would relate to it. And that this book would be really helpful for, does that kind of resonate with what you're doing in it?
Yeah. Well, thanks so much, Mike, for the words. And my hope is that anyone who has ever experienced any form of loss or pain or just the unexpected, you know, when life does what life often does, which just shocks you and change just shows up. And I don't think I ever was taught how to lament or how to grieve, you know, like I was taught how to perform and how to achieve and how to, you know, almost like just maybe stack those grievances, those moments, those difficulty, but never to honor it. And so part of the heart of the book is trying to help people within my own kind of like little narrative, and through the text and some stuff I learned around therapy along the way to really kind of create a framework that will hopefully help people honor what comes up when change shows up in their life. And grieve, breathe, receive in my own way is a little bit like Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and learning to kind of understand that, man, there is something in that holy weekend that, again, many of us in our church experiences, the weekend is a time for joy and celebration and everything is up and to the right. But what we were basically saying is like, hey, your grief, your mourning, your sadness, your lament isn't welcome here. And if we're not teaching our people how to do that, then I also don't know if we can fully experience the actual joy of what Sunday offers as well. And so how do you hold the Friday and even the Saturday of waiting and to experience the surprise of Sunday? So that's kind of the heartbeat and the hope of the book.
Yeah. It's so good. Genuinely, friends, we're not going to spend the rest of the podcast unpacking his newest book, which I wish we could. But I just wanted to make sure that you got to hear a little bit about it, because I think it's something that you will want to pick up and you'll appreciate. So Grieve, Breathe, Receive, check it out by Steve Carter. Find it on in all the places. But Steve, we're jumping into, we're on chapter 6 this week of The Divine Conspiracy, which Dallas Willard entitled Investing in the Heavens, Escaping the Deceptions of Reputation and Wealth. And before like we get into the specifics of some of the stuff that we notice in the chapter, I'm curious to hear a little bit of your Dallas Willard story of like how you became aware of him and the Divine Conspiracy. And then I know that you got some chances to interact with him. How did that come about?
Yep. So, in 1999, my parents had been just really new to the faith. I had grown up kind of going to like a Christian school, was at the same, you and I were at the same college, and my dad decided to sell out of his company and move to Grand Rapids, Michigan. So this is like 99. We moved there, and that was the right at the start of Mars Hill in Grand Rapids with Rob Bell. And so I started going there and got connected to Rob, and Rob knew I was wanting to go into ministry and basically said, hey, I asked him like, what should I be reading? And he handed me Divine Conspiracy. He said, read this. It'll change everything. So I tried to read it on the flight home. And this was a couple of years later, after 99. But this was like, I would go back there to see my family after school. So that, I think this is like early 2000s, you know. And I tried to read it, and it took me a while to get through it, to be honest. I mean, I think I got to chapter 3 7 different times before finally making it through the book. But once I read it, I think I learned this from Rob, to be honestly. He said, you know, anytime you read something or you learn something, find that, track that person down and tell them thank you. And so I called USC because Dallas was a philosophy professor at the University of Southern California. And when I called the department, the assistant to the department said, oh, Steve, I'm so sorry. Dallas, and I think she thought I was a student. She said, Dallas is on sabbatical this semester. Would you like his home number? And I said, I would. And so she gave me his home number. And so I called. It rang 4 times, went to the voicemail, and then it was, you know, you've reached the house of Jane and Dallas Willard. You know, like just the drawl of Dallas. You can leave a message if you liked, or you know. And so I left a message. I gave him my phone number. I didn't have a cell phone at that time, but to the Nutwood Apartments with me and Tommy and Casey. And so he didn't call. So it kind of became this joke, like, you got to get Dallas to talk to you, because I kept talking about the book. And I came home the next day, and Tommy's like, did you call Dallas? I was like, nope, I dial it up, go ring 4 times, go to the voicemail, and I'd leave another message. I probably did this 50 days. And then one day, no joke, the phone picks up, and I start sweating profusely, and it's Jane Willard. And Jane Willard says, thank you, Steve. Dallas has received all of your messages, and he's so grateful that you love the book. And then she said, goodbye now. And she hung up. And it was like the sweetest, most like, don't ever call here again. We have a restraining order on you. So that happens. Then Mars Hill, my first sermon I ever give at Mars Hill, Rob and I are walking through the kingdom of God, but through the book. And we're doing different teachings on the kingdom of God based on the chapters. And that was my first like sermon I ever gave at Mars Hill. And then I'll just say this, the next time I hang out with Dallas, Mars Hill's like 6 of us got time. We went and spent with Dallas. And Dallas sits down with us, and he begins to ask us our name, what we do. And so the first person goes, says their name, full name. And he hears, he's all, thank you. He goes to the next person, next person, next person. Then he gets to me and he goes, and you? I'm like, oh, my name's Steve Carter. And I'll never forget, Mike, I'll never forget. He's like looking at his food, and I say my whole name, and he looks at me, and I just nod. I'm like, yeah, I'm him. And he looks at me, and he just shakes his head and doesn't ever bring it up, just shakes his head. And everyone was like, what happened in that moment after he left? And I tell them the story and they're like, are you kidding me? I'm like, I was 20 years old, guys, leave me alone, you know? And so, yeah, that's my Dallas Willard story. And then was really blessed to have a number of times, you know, talking vision, intention, means, talking kingdom of God. He just was a real gift from afar.
Oh my gosh. There's so many things about that I love. I love Jane's response to you. I love, like, this has been my experience of you, that kind of tenacity of going after a thing like that is so quintessentially you. And that moment that you get to have with him where it comes full circle is really beautiful.
I mean, it's something, you know what I mean? It's a good story. I mean, and what's amazing is sometimes you have those moments where you, like, you do that and you never get a hold of the person. And then sometimes it's like Parker Palmer just picked up the phone and I'm talking to him for 30 minutes. And you're
like, did you call Parker Palmer?
I did. He lives in Madison, Wisconsin, and just had this amazing conversation with him. You know, and like Phyllis Tickle did that one. You're like, so it's just like you have these, and then other times you're like, I couldn't get past the secretary, you know, I couldn't get past the EA, you know, but it's all good.
Yeah, dude. That's really phenomenal. There's a few people that have passed away that I didn't get to spend time with that I wish I would have. And Dallas is at the top of the list of those folks that I didn't get to spend any one-on-one time with him.
Yeah.
So in this chapter, he is walking through some more of the Sermon on the Mount, and he begins with here's his translation of what he begins with. It's Jesus saying, be careful not to do your rightness before human beings with the intent of being seen by them. Otherwise, your Father, the one in the heavens, will have nothing to do with it. And he kind of picks up on this theme of, like, in order to be seen, that there's something about that that becomes really significant. In this part, it becomes significant when he talks about prayer. And then he says this, he says, our intent is determined by what we want and expect from our action. And so what we want from our action is to be seen, to be noticed, to like have some sort of that. And then it goes on and he says, they've received their reward in full. They got what they want. That and that he would talk about the idea that, like, God respects what your intent and action is. And so if what you want is to experience, like, other people noticing you, God will step aside, and because that doesn't concern God. And this, like, as I was rereading it, there's a few things in this chapter, this, and particularly when we talk about the money stuff that he talks about. But this was really messing with me a bit. I'm kind of curious, like, how it hit you.
Yeah, no, I think that whole reward in full is really a conversation on motivation, right? Like, and I think especially when we think about pastoral ministry, you know, every Sunday you're seen, you're showing your work. And I don't know any pastor who's like, you know what, I just really just want to give a terrible sermon. You know what I mean? So there's this, like, you're motivated by good to kind of like help people be shaped and formed in the way of Jesus. And yet intrinsically connected to that is if people like it, they come back. And if people like it, they often will invite their friends. And if people like it, they'll often give. So it can get really, really clouded very, very quickly because it's like, I'm trying to do the most good. And I'm trying to help people, but how I help people is by crafting these messages, and I want them to like it. I want them to stay connected. I want them to give for our staff and for the ministry to have more, incarnational like help. But like, it is a very, very fine line, because all connected to that is I need these people to like me. And you could lose your prophetic voice. You could not talk about issues of justice or difficult textual matters because you're like, I know that might upset this group of people. And at the same time, you can like curry a whole bunch of like, I don't like, just you're like, you need support or favor or emotional connection, and you might get some applause. And to Dallas's point, and to your point, and to Jesus's point, it's like, well, you got what you wanted. You wanted a very, very safe congregation where people actually affirmed you, and you were seen as good and right and all of this. But you didn't want to like disrupt it, but you got what you wanted. And think about this from like Instagram. I'll go on Instagram and I'll see people that I'm like, I think they were feeling insecure today and they created a post and they got 87 likes on that post. And it's like, it's like Jesus is saying, you received what you wanted in full, all 87 likes. Like that's what you wanted, was to have them validate you as worthy or as good. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I think that's where too many of us are attempting to try and be seen and known or experienced as something, rather than actually trusting. Now it's the goodness of God, the belovedness of the Father and of the Son and the Spirit that's like actually shaping who we are, not what I do or how well people like me or dislike me.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I was thinking a bit about, like he goes on to talk about the Puritan's idea of like, we do this for an audience of one. And that sounds really lovely. And it also can feel really trite and small. And like we in the church space become really good at like saying those right kinds of things. And there is like this deeper work that has to get done. And one of the reasons I was excited to talk to you about this chapter is because like you have done that deeper work personally. And then like you've unpacked it for us in The Thing Beneath the Thing, unpack it for us in Grieve, Breathe, Receive. And like the differentiation between when I'm doing a thing that's a good thing, the rightness, the righteousness, the I'm doing the thing that's the good thing, and how am I differentiating and like being able to be honest enough to know, is that because of this shadow side, this false self of me, that like what the actual motivation is? Like how I feel like it's really hard to be able to be honest with ourselves about like what is actually driving the thing that I'm doing, especially when it's good things that I'm doing.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point, Mike. I think the, you know, my counselor often will say, slow is smooth and smooth is fast. And her husband's a firefighter. And, you know, when he's having to like, after going out and putting out a fire, you know, they're kind of winding up the hose. They got to make sure that there's no kinks in that hose. And so they have to go slow, and slow is smooth and smooth is fast. I think that the older I've gotten, the slower I've had to actually go to make sure I'm aware of my motivation. I think before I just gave it the benefit of the doubt that I was like, oh yeah, of course I want to do this for the right reasons. But the more that I started to interrogate that, I was like, oh, I just am people pleasing. I want that person to like me. I want to be seen as smarter or more connected or more important. Like, and I think as I started to like sit with that, I was like, oh my God, like that's really in me. And I think because I was moving so fast, I never had to actually sit with that. And I remember like processing it with Hal, and you, Mike, you know, Hal, and, you know, he was probably, you know, he was my youth pastor, mentor, just a revolutionary. But, you know, Hal would always tell me, he'd say, Steve, you have to understand, to be a pastor means that you will not make everybody happy. You will disappoint people and you will be somebody's heretic. And if you can't live with that, don't be a pastor. And I remember like nodding my head going, yeah, yeah, I get that. I get that. But I didn't get it, because I think that there are decisions that we have to ask ourselves, you know, it's like Black Lives Matter. Oh my goodness. What's happening in Gaza and Israel? Oh my goodness. Like all of these situations, culture that for many of us are like, I don't want to say anything. Ask yourself why. Or I do want to say something. ask yourself why. Because sometimes it's like, I want to be seen as more progressive than I actually am, or that I've done my work. And you have to just sit with that motivation and to ask yourself, oh, what is this really about? Who am I trying to curry favor from or for, rather than actually being an integrated person? Last thing I'll say on this, just for that one piece, is my grandfather is buried at West Point. And I don't know if you've ever read the Cadet's Prayer. It's one of the most beautiful prayers, but in the early 1900s, every cadet who went to West Point had to memorize it. But it has this line, may we be more connected to the harder right over the lesser wrong. May we live above the common level of life. And I think part of that thing that Dallas and Jesus are getting at is, hey, that's good that you want to like pray and you want to fast. Those are beautiful things. But the harder right is really the integrated motivation behind it. What are you actually trying to embody? Is it that you're holier, that you're better, that you're more seen as righteous? Or is it actually because you're deeply longing to be connected and actually understand, man, there are these parts in my life, this is why I'm fasting, that they're idols, or I can't seem to get that connection. And this is, by removing something, is helping me make more space. Like it just is an invitation to get very curious and interrogate our real reason for why we do what we do.
Yeah. Gosh. So many things in that. First, I was tearing up a little as you were talking about the, like, why am I speaking up or why am I not speaking up? I was just this morning, I've been using the last couple of years, Emily P. Freeman puts out a journal that's called The Next Right Thing.
Yeah.
And it's been just kind of like a helpful guide for me at like sort of like long-term processing over a year. And one of the things she has you process every month is just like, what questions are you carrying with you this month? And you just like are jotting down. I once a week open this up for 5 minutes and I jot down, what are the questions I'm carrying with me this month? And one of the things I just wrote down 2.5 hours ago, this morning when I was going through it, was why have I not been showing up more publicly in spaces that I used to show up more publicly in? And I don't know what that all is, but like that's been like, I was like, gosh, this is sitting here with me and I'm starting to realize this some, and some of it is just brought about by different circumstances that have been going on. And I was like, gosh, I'm not showing up in ways that I used to show up, and what is going on in me that's causing that? And so like, I love the idea of, and appreciate like this curiosity that calls us to like radically investigate ourselves, and that we can't just do on our own, that like we need wise guides, we need friends, we need like, it requires vulnerability. Like even before we started recording, that I was sharing with you like just a little bit of like some of what was like sitting there for me that I'm trying to process through there. And like, I need to have people like give me feedback and hear that. And I need that from friends, and I need that from professionals, and to like, what is the actual motivation that's going on there? And is it good? Or am I trying to hide from something? And am I trying to hide from something by withdrawal? Or am I trying to hide from something by doing things to look a certain way? Like, it requires this like real hard, regular, continual work that doesn't stop.
Yeah. No, I think it's really good the way that you ended that sentence. Real work continually that never stops. That is at the heart of formation in so many ways. And, you know, I think that if you were to really look at my life and say, man, who is really Steve tried to be like? I think it was Ferris Bueller growing up. Like there was something about Ferris I just loved. People, he knew how to connect people. He knew, there was just, no one was ever mad at Ferris outside of his sister and the principal, but like no one really was mad at Ferris. And I think for a lot of pastors, we've almost had this kind of, no one's ever really been mad at us. Like, no one's ever really been really frustrated with us. And then 2020 hit, you know, and some of the previous elections hit. And all of a sudden it was like, oh, this isn't fun anymore. People are really frustrated. And when I left Willow, there were people who were not nice, and they didn't fully understand why I did what I did. But I would get these messages on social media, and I mean, obliterating me for, you're a coward, you abandon us, you have no integrity. I mean, and I remember like calling John Ortberg 4 or 5 months after I had left, and you and I both love J.O. He's been hugely impactful in our story. But I remember telling him this, and he just said, Steve, the death of the ego is one of the most profound invitations to going deeper and deeper with Jesus. And so every time that statement that someone says hurts you, acknowledge the hurt. And maybe you can just say, thanks be to God that my identity isn't found in what that person actually thinks about me. And maybe even there's an invitation to repent a little, because the way they see you has probably cared a little more than it ought to have. And it was so like so kind and such like a little bit of a jab that I didn't see coming. But it was so helpful for me, because it gave me almost the full spectrum to honor. Oh yeah, there's a part of me that like really wants them to love me. I can't change the way they feel about me. Oh my goodness, I've given them way too much precious real estate on my identity. And there's something I need to own. But here's an invitation to say, Jesus, I need to have you and the way you see me have more residence in my heart and mind and body and soul and spirit.
It's really good. So you were talking about one of the things that you learned from Dallas is what he called VIM, which was vision, intention, means. And that was kind of like a simple way to communicate what the process of spiritual formation looks like, right? They had this vision of kingdom living, that this is the kind of life that Jesus declared and called us into. You have an intention of moving in that direction. And then you have the means, the what we might call spiritual disciplines or habits, the things that we do that help form us in ways for that to become our reality. And then one of the things he talks about in that way in this chapter is, in order to, like, if we want this to be true of us, if we want to be the kinds of people who are not doing our rightness in order to be seen for certain accolades and to be noticed in certain kind of ways, but out of a integrated, more pure sort of place, he talks about a discipline of secrecy. And he says that it's a discipline, which is not a law and is not a rule. He's always like real careful to say like, these things aren't laws and rules. And I love his definition of discipline. The one that he uses here on this one is, he says, a discipline is an activity in our power that we do to enable us to do what we cannot do by direct effort.
Yes.
So like, I'm curious about a couple of things. I'm curious to hear like what other disciplines or habits, or formation tools are helpful for you that you do in your power that enables you to do what you can't do on your own, specifically as we think about like what he's bringing up here about like the way we get trapped in trying to be perceived in a certain way. So curious about that. I'm curious if the discipline of secrecy, if that's been something that's been helpful for you, if you are able to talk about that and break your rule of secrecy around it.
Well, I think when you think about them, one of the most beautiful pieces, like, and you laid it out so beautifully, you know, and do you have a kingdom vision? I think most people know the vision of their church or their company, but they don't have a specific vision that they're working on. Those means and practices are beautiful, but that intention is really a conversation about will. You know, you have an impulsive will, which you just want to do what you want to do, or you kind of have this reflective will where you see that this choice that comes at you, there is that invitation to really become that vision or not. Like, you can actually take a step closer to being that vision or not. But what Dallas taught me that changed everything for me. He said underneath impulsive will and reflective will is what he called embodied will. And that's the muscle memory that comes that by the choices we make. And if we keep making choices where I have to be seen, I have to be celebrated, I have to be applauded, I have to be known, I have to be beloved, you're going to have to keep feeding that, because that impulsive will has muscle memory. But if you have the reflective will to do it, what you're talking about, and look at it and go, man, this isn't going to be helpful. I need to have that kind of discipline of secrecy. That's actually, you're not going to need those hits, those likes, those, all of those things like you once did. And so that's, then you get to be your vision. So that for me has been really, really helpful. I'll also say, Mike, you and I actually practiced this a couple years ago. You and I, we were at a kind of like a little retirement celebration for someone that we love. And we had people kind of share some stories. And I'll never forget one of the people who shared the stories was a therapist. And he was honoring this pastor that we just love. And the therapist said, I'll never forget 8 years ago, this guy called me and said, hey, can I call you every morning at 5:30 a.m.? And can I just confess my sin? And you confess your sin to me, and then we can tell each other that we're forgiven. And the therapist was like, I don't want to do that. 5:30 a.m. No way. But the guy came back a couple weeks later, called, and the guy said, finally, I'll do it. And for 8 years, they did this Monday through Friday, and they only missed 7 mornings. And I'll never forget like hearing this story. And these guys were in their 60s. And I remember like as you and I were walking away from that celebration, like we looked at each other and they're like, those two guys want Jesus more than we do. Like they're waking up early. They are confessing. They are like entering into a secret life of depth. And I'm like, can we try that? And so you and I tried, and I'll be honest, you were way better at it than I was. I think in 2 months we missed 8 times because I slept through my alarm. But I realized you've got to be able to name something and then try to put it into practice and really get curious of how that's working. I have to check myself, like, why am I trying to post right now on social media? What am I really wanting? I have to ask myself, like, what is it? What's my real reason for showing up to this place or this conversation? And sometimes it's never 100% pure and 0% bad or vice versa. But if it's 70-30, I got to get curious. If it's 80-20, I just want to get a little curious. And so for me, it's probably every 90 days, I just try to have a couple practices that I'm just trying to grow in that's connected to a vision. My kind of vision for this season comes from Dallas. J.O. taught it to me, John Ortberg. But it's like you ought to arrange your days where you're experiencing the deepest levels of contentment, joy, and confidence in your everyday walk with the Lord. So joy and contentment, well, how I can say that, but how do I actually create moments where in secrecy I'm learning how to be content? And so there's a couple of practices that I've connected to each one of those, confidence, joy, and contentment, that for me, I'm just trying to hope, almost like not skip leg day, and actually shape and form so that I can experience more of what I think the kingdom in Christ has. So is that mm-hmm. helpful to answer your question? But that's for me trying to make it practical for that.
No, it's super helpful. I actually found one of the things for me that I've done, and I think this might be unique to people who preach, but because you constantly need to have stories, and you need to have illustrations, and you need sort of things. And so I've always tried to be committed to some things that I will do that I decide before I do them, that this never gets told in a public space, that I'm going to, whatever the thing is. And so it like frees me from when I'm engaging in it, thinking about what I can use from it. And sometimes, honestly, I'm really bummed about it, that I'm like, why the crap did I make this commitment here? Because this would play real, like this would it would work really well. It wouldn't just play really well. It would be actually a really helpful like thing for me to share with people to do this thing. But I committed before I did it that this never gets used in a public way.
And wait, can you just explain this? Like, give me like a, cause I think I understand. I'm like,
okay.
Like you're like, let's say you're going to have a conversation with someone who's struggling and you're like, this is not going to be sermon material. Or put me in that situation. Cause like I don't do this and I need to do this. There's something about what you're saying is resonating. And I'm like, but can you give me a real life example to play out?
Yeah. I'm trying to think about like how to do it without violating myself here. So it might be that there is a organization or something in the city or something that I'm going to serve with. And I decide when I serve with this group, like I'll talk to friends and stuff about it or talk to Allison about it, but I'm never going to talk about it in a public way. I'm not going to post about it. I'm not going to put it into a sermon. I'm not going to like write about it. Like it's only going to be this thing that I did that others don't know about. Or maybe like, and I know that you have done this, that there are things that I only know about because of our relationship that you have helped out with financially. There are things that we help out with financially that we have decided, not because we're trying to cover it up, but we've decided this needs to be our thing that we're doing this. There's a relationship that I initiated several years ago with somebody that is a very, very difficult relationship where there needs to be like tons of restorative work that has to be done and super complex. And I decided going into it, like this is for me to do and not for me to talk about. So I think about like my favorite example of this is Eugene Peterson has this like develops this relationship with Bono from U2, right? And the thing that we learned after Eugene died was that he kept this daily journal where he recorded everything from his day. And the only thing that's not in his journal are the times that he met with Bono, because presumably he knew people would want to know what they talked about. And he knew that that was between he and Bono and God, and that that wasn't for anybody else.
Dude, he didn't need it. He didn't need it like that you would expect that someone would need it. And to have that level of foresight to be like, oh, someday someone might read this and I want to make sure. And gosh, that's so moving. Have you ever had a moment, Mike, where you made that, I'm not even going to say it's a vow, but you made that, and then all of a sudden you felt like the Lord said, hey, there's been enough time now. There's something. Like I understand why you did what you did, but there's permission here. Where you've almost been able to change it?
I've had a couple of instances of things I've shared in sermons that were that case, that were things I thought I would never talk about, that I felt that permission and tried to process it with a couple of people to try and figure out like what's the motivating thing behind this. I don't fully trust. It's not that I don't trust myself. I think that's the wrong way of saying it, because that feels like sliding into a place where like we can't trust what's going on inside of us. But that like I just know I have a lot of capacity to trick myself into thinking I'm doing something for good motives.
Yeah.
And so it's plausible that like some of the stuff that like I'll do right now. But I know I need to do it right now with that just because of me. Like, I don't know that everybody needs to do this, right? Like, but I know for me, especially as like somebody shows up as a 3 on the Enneagram who wants to like put things out in a way so that people have a certain perception of me, that there needs to be some things that I do that the only way I can enter into it well is to say like, this is only for me. It's not for public consumption.
Yes. Again, that's that discipline of secrecy, I think is, I think there's just something that it's like a 401k. It's just an investment that you don't actually get to see in real time, but over time, somehow in the kingdom economy, it just grows and grows and grows. Like what's the great Dallas story too, where you know, he was some college students from a California college showed up and were like, after he had spoke, and we're just grilling him. And he just kind of listened and just nodded his head and thanked them and walked away. And I think it was Ortberg who looked at him and said, "Why didn't you decimate them? You could have destroyed them." And he goes, "I'm practicing not having the last word. And yeah. I'm practicing not being the smartest person in the room." I mean, like, just to think of his like knowledge and be like, I don't need to have the last word. That discipline of secrecy, to not win an argument, to not this, but to be, I'm so trusted and grounded in who God says I am, not what these college students or that congregant in the fourth row or that email or that blogger or that person on Twitter. It's just a game changer.
Yeah, it's so good. And it's a helpful distinction that he makes between like a discipline and a law. Like,
yeah,
we get to choose these things that are helpful for us, which is very freeing for me of like, if it's not helpful, then he would be like, well, throw it out. Don't do it. If it's not helping you like become that kingdom vision, well, then get rid of it and do something that is helpful for you. And so if like secrecy isn't helpful for you, like do something else. It's not a law. It's not a rule. It's a habit that builds this muscle that increases our capacity for the Spirit to like do this thing in our life that we can't do by our own direct effort.
Yeah.
It's good. The other thing I want to make sure that we talk on, and we talked a long time about that. That's like the first like three pages of the chapter.
two preachers.
The other, know. Right? The other thing I want to make sure that we talk about is I want to talk about what he talks about with money a little bit. And talks about the idea of investing your resources in kingdom orientations in a way that don't create a, I'm trying to think about like, he doesn't use this language. This is language I learned later from Walter Brueggemann, but of scarcity and abundance. And I feel like he's like, you need to treat your resources. And he builds this first out of fasting that he talks about. I think he talks about fasting as like, you are receiving spiritual nourishment and it's actually affecting you in a physical way. So it's like, you don't need this. You go without food, but your food is doing the will of the one who sent you. And so in some sort of way, there is this like spiritual thing that is providing physical nourishment, which I think we could probably like, if we had more time, that would be an interesting one to poke into also.
Yeah.
But I feel like he takes that idea then with money and is like, here's this thing, this tangible physical thing that like you just kind of need to function in society. But you're going to live in a way that trusts that, that there's a spiritual resource that's going to provide for you there. And a part of why I wanted to talk to you about this is because in Grieve, Breathe, Receive, you talk about a time where you had to make a significant financial decision with a book advance that you had been given, and at a time where you didn't have a steady paycheck coming in. And I'll set this all up and I'll let you talk. A part of the reason I wanted to have you share a bit about that, if you've want to talk about that, is because like I think it was easier for me to think about scarcity and abundance with my finances when I had a steady paycheck. And then when I left the church and I was doing work in ways where every month looks completely different, I very quickly moved into a scarcity mindset. And it's been a battle to move into an abundant mindset that says that God is a good God and I trust God to provide, that this is, as Dallas says, a perfectly safe world. It has been a lot of work to like continually try to move there. And when I read that story, and I'd known about that, but just like rereading it, it was like this reminder to me of like the way that you did that and leaned into that in a season that could have been a season of scarcity for you.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that Dallas does, and you just alluded to it so well, is you can read something at face value and he just almost just expands out and you see how it's all connected, whether through fasting or through money, like how my level of trust and So the short story is, the way that I found out about the allegations that were coming out about Bill Hybels was I submitted a manuscript. It was the second book in a 3-book contract, and it was all based on Paul and Timothy's relationship. And in many ways, it was a treatise to Bill. And my editor basically wrote back and goes, do you want to add a chapter when someone falls or fails? And I'm like, well, that didn't happen in Timothy. And then began to tell me about the story that was coming in the Chicago Tribune. And I'm like, how did you know? What? So I obviously pull that book from print that doesn't come out. I leave Willow, and the publisher says, hey, you have 2 books left. If you write 1 book about what happened at Willow, we'll call it even and we'll pay you more. And
so they've already paid you for these books that you haven't yet written.
They've
and so you have that money.
Yeah, I have a – so the way the advances work, you typically get a third from each book. And then when the book – they accept the manuscript, you get the next third. And when you get – when the book comes out, you get a third. So I had basically been paid a third for all 3 books, but I hadn't had the 2/3 paid from the last 2 books. So – but they're like, hey, we'll just do this 1 book and we'll pay you more money. So I was like, no job. Okay. And I start writing this, and on some of it, man, it was just really, I was hurt. I was angry. I was frustrated. The truth wasn't out there. People are saying terrible things about me. My identity, like, I felt like the truth wasn't out there. The women weren't being, like, redeemed. It was just re-traumatized. It didn't feel like good was winning out, and I was pissed. And so I started writing. And then I realized, oh crap, what had I done? I don't want this to get out there. This is all angry. And so basically to break that, I had to go through my savings and basically pay them to buy myself out of the contract. And Mike, I have to tell you, like, that was no fun to have to tell my wife. It's no fun to have to tell my kids, hey, I entertained this. I entertained vengeance, and it was connected to something, and I'm not ready to write this. And I could blame a whole bunch of people saying they came after me. It doesn't matter. I had all of the agency in the world to say I'm not ready, and out of my scarcity and out of my anger and out of my desire for the truth and vengeance, I entertained it. And I had to pay for it. And that took me a while to forgive myself. And I think that's, to Dallas's point, one decision is connected to so much. And, you know, I think in Paul quotes Jesus when he's leaving the church in Ephesus, and he says, it is more better to give than to receive. And I don't think many of us believe that to be true. But when you start to think neurologically, when you start to think about, you know, people who volunteer tend to live 4 years longer than someone who doesn't. When you start to see, when you live in an abundance mindset and a trusting of the goodness of God mindset, you're more at peace than you do when you're tightly wound and scarce. And you make healthier decisions from a place of trust than of fear. And so you start to see those levels of connection. And, you know, I feel like even with Grieve, Breathe, Receive, I'm writing it from a wildly different space than what I wrote 4.5 years ago. And that's not out of vengeance, not out of scarcity, but out of thanks be to God. Like, you did a work and you taught me something that I can actually tell people about some of these dumb decisions I made. And hopefully that will help people to go and save them a bunch of money, not to entertain, you know, scarcity minded thinking.
Yeah. Yeah. So you write this book because you're in a scarcity place, and understandably so. But then it feels like when you decide to empty your savings to pay it back, to not have to produce that book, like, it feels like you move into this place of, and tell me if I'm wrong on this, of believing that the divine provides and that the divine will care for you in this, to be able to, like, zero everything out without that steady paycheck. Did you have, like, what was the experience of that side of it?
Yeah, I think believing is probably too strong of a word. I think hoping, you know, to be honest. You know, Rob used to always talk about, you know, kind of like this simple, complex, simple. Kind of, you know, you go, there's like a simple truth and goes through like this complexity, whether trauma, struggle, whatever it is. And when that simple kind of idea, God is with you, or God is for you, or God is good, or God is worthy to be trusted, when it goes through the complexity and through the fire, it becomes simple yet sacred and weighty. And I think that's it. I hope this to be true. I've read it in Divine Conspiracy. I've seen it in the Gospels. But I haven't known it. And then when you walk in the desert and you feel forsaken and you recognize, oh my goodness, this is true and it's going to be okay, then all of a sudden it moves from, I hope so, to, oh, I believe it because I've experienced it. There's like an embodied wisdom that has come from it that I can trust it in other areas, not just with money, but with my kids' future. I can trust it with, you know, because I think for many of us, we spend so much energy trying to bypass the desert, trying to bypass the wilderness, trying to bypass the place where we have to sit in that cognitive dissonance. But it's in that complex, in that struggle, that the things of God become much, much weightier and sacred and personal and wildly, wildly helpful for the complexity that we're all having to walk through called this life.
Oh, man. It's so good. We skipped over so much here. Is there anything, I was going to close this out, but I just want to make sure, is there anything that you wanted to make sure we talked about from here that we didn't get to talk about?
No, I mean, this has been a beautiful conversation, but you're right. It's like you can get to page, it's like three pages and you're like, oh man, like you could spend a whole season just on one chapter, you know, like, cause there's so much in this book. One thing I would say though, so I had the privilege to be at like Dallas's last speaking engagement. He did it at Westmont and there was like this conference and I think this is like a moment that really symbolizes what you're talking about. He was supposed to give six talks, but because he was so frail, I mean, the suit just hung off his body because of the cancer. And he was going to do a talk on the power of a blessing. And he was going to do like the blessing from Numbers, the Aaronic benediction blessing. And he got up and he asked, would you all give a blessing over me? And you watch this man who's so wise and strong. And then all of a sudden, in this like most supernatural way, 200 people stand up and recite this over him. And you realize something, these weren't just words, but this was something that was like connected to his own trust in the abundance and goodness of God. It wasn't financial. It was like this, like a reminder of powerful and the sacred and the profound likeness of words for his heart in that season as he was preparing to leave one reality and enter into another. And so I have that to say, gosh, money or words or time, it's all of it is connected to so much more. And the more we can get attuned to the motivation and the real reason we're doing it and understand that it's so much bigger and wider and deeper than we could have ever imagined, I think it allows us to have the purity to see more of what God is up to in real time.
So good. That's so good. I'm going to leave it there. Steve Ryan Carter, thanks for being on the podcast today. Just what a gift. What a gift. Thanks, man.
Love you, man. Thank you.
Thank you.